Explore the mystery at shrouduniversity.com.
We are only 2 years away from a fresh exhibition of the Turin Shroud. And with that, will there be another round of testing? In this light, it seems a valuable exercise to recap previous hypotheses regarding the C-14 results offered in the years following the 1988 testing. Professionally, I am an archaeologist. Some of you might call me an antique historian. This is a paper about history. What I shall attempt to do here is to gather together in one place observations and explanations that have been published elsewhere. There are many things about the Shroud we would all like to know, but in this paper, I shall deal largely with only one question. What went wrong with the Shroud's radiocarbon date? I will provide here a brief synopsis of proposed answers with focused explanations of one of those proposals. A strange story. But first, I want to share with you a strange story. Many of you have already heard it. I first heard it many years ago as it was circulated by Bill Meacham. A single thread of the Shroud was sent surreptitiously to a West Coast laboratory in 1982. One end of that thread came up with a date of 200 AD, while the other end resulted in a day of about 1,000. How could this be? I thought about it long and hard and finally dismissed it as a complete fluke. Anyway, that was quite a yarn. Bill Meacham preserves this story in his most recent book, published a few years ago. Here's another story, also old. So much you're probably all tired of hearing it. Briefly, on April 21st, 1988, a single sample was removed from the so-called Raz Corner on the Shroud by the late Giovanni Rigi di Numana. This was divided up between three labs, Oxford, Zurich, and Tucson. Results analyzed by the British Museum. The analysis from that testing was released on October 13, 1988. The cellulose taken from the Shroud was to be dated with 95% confidence to between 1260 to 1390 AD. Most of us reacted at first with a mixture of shock and consternation. How could this be? The late Father Albert Dreisbach liked to say that the preponderance of evidence argued for the antiquity as well as the authenticity of the cloth. After all, how could the Shroud have been rendered in artistry some 60 years before the first bracket of the 1260-1390 released carbon date? As we all began to recover, it was generally agreed that something was radically wrong. The question was, what? There have been six major approaches to this question. Evaluative remarks and commentary have been confined to the footnotes due to time constraints this morning. When something this painful hits, often a case of cognitive dissonance sets in. Perhaps the first to react publicly was the late Father Werner Bolst. At a conference in the spring of 1989 held in Bologna, Italy, he voiced his opinion that somehow something fraudulent had happened. Samples must have been dishonestly switched. But it remained for Brother Bruno Bonnet-Aimard to study this possibility in detail and set it in print repeatedly in the pages of the Catholic Counter-Reformation in the 21st century. It was picked up by other Shroud publications and disseminated around the world. The second approach. Marie-Claire van Oosterwyck-Gastuc, a Belgian chemist now living in France, while agreeing with the suggestion of Father Werner Bolst and Brother Bruno Bonnet-Aimard that the radiocarbon date was a fabrication, she goes further to completely and unequivocally rule out the reliability of radiocarbon dating in this circumstance. She believes that no application of C-14 testing to Shroud samples will ever produce an accurate or believable result. Now, I wish to make clear here that she does not abrogate C-14 dating per se, but she does insist that where water may be involved, the results are not to be trusted. third approach. Meanwhile, even in France, not all accepted the Bolst Bruno Bonnet Maire proposal. Members of the scientific committee of CIELT, headquartered in Paris, contacted the wealthy industrialist Guy Berthault, who generously funded the now well-known work of Dmitry Kuznetsov and his associates in Moscow. Their proposal was that during the fire of 1532, the heat induced cellulose changes in a water vapor atmosphere which caused the isotopic exchange of modern radiocarbon or carboxylation, which altered the date of the shroud and make it appear considerably younger. Jackson and his colleagues gave this proposal a strong chance. Fourth approach. Another proposal was made by Leoncio A. Garza Valdez, who published his findings of a coating on the yarns of the Roz Corner. This film he called a biogenic or bioplastic coating. He suggested that it had been created by microbial action, just as desert patina is left on rocks and some ancient artifacts. In the case of the shroud, he identified this microbe as lichenophilia. This would mean that modern extraneous carbon would have intruded into the cloth where the sample was removed. Radiocarbon specialists had, in fact, admitted to me that if proven, microbial involvement could indeed alter the date. Follow-up studies, particularly with cloth taken from an ibis mummy, found some support from such experts as Harry Gove, the co-inventor of the accelerator mass spectrometer technology that was used to test the shroud samples in 1988. Fifth approach. Another interesting proposal began with a statement by Thomas Phillips in a letter to Nature, in which he suggested that radiation could cause a skewing of the date. This idea was developed in detail by the French scientist J.B. Renaudot, in which a neutron flux would have occurred and was eventually connected with a resurrection event which caused the image. This became clear in his paper entitled The Cause of the Image on the Shroud and the Results of the Radiocarbon Date, a Cohering Hypothesis. Soon the German scientist Eberhard Lindner also added his support to this thesis in his writings. In all of this, the argument has been that a neutron flux would not only make the date of the shroud appear younger than it really was, it also would have contributed to making the image itself. And I can report that this thesis is still being probed with experimentation, some of which may be shared at this conference. Sixth approach. At Orvieto in Italy, in the late summer of 2000, M. Sue Benford and Joseph Marino presented what, in my opinion, was perhaps the cream paper, among many other very fine papers of that entire conference. They proposed that there had been an invisible reweave of the so-called Roz Corner, and had three modern experts in the field of textile technology who verified it from photographs. Despite this, based on her personal investigation of the shroud linen, it was completely ruled out by textile conservationist Mechthild Fleury-Lemberg of the Arbeit Stiftung in Berg, Switzerland, who convinced even the late Alan Adler that he was wrong in his earlier support of the idea. But this story doesn't end there. More recently, STRP member and chemist Raymond N. Rogers of the Los Alamos National Laboratory examined this theory. In addition to the 14 threads taken from the Roz sample in 1979, he also received an additional number of threads in December of 2003 via the good offices of Amstar from Luigi Ganella, extracted from the center of the remaining piece that had been retained in the collection held by Giovanni Rigi di Numana after the radiocarbon sampling removal. These he studied and produced the results the reader will see in the paper from Thermochimica Acta. What Rogers really set out to do was to examine and test the fresh threads and prove the Benford Merino theory false. He told one of our colleagues, "I'll prove them wrong in 5 minutes." Several hours later, he called back and said, in some consternation, "They may be right after all." Statements like that never came easy for Ray. But as a scientist, as a chemist, he was rigorous and honest to his profession. Seventh approach. A new approach has recently been offered by John Jackson. The Oxford lab will be involved, and they will be testing the most recent proposal to explain what went wrong. In this case, the hypothesis of a 2% shift in radiocarbon by carbon monoxide contamination. Brian Walsh notes that near the Earth's surface, C14 monoxide is naturally about 5 times more abundant as a percentage of all CO than C14 dioxide is as a percentage of all CO2. The samples will probably come from Jackson's Colorado Research Group and will not likely to have been obtained from the shroud itself. Let's take a closer look. Here's an important question. Is the so-called Ross Corner homogeneous or heterogeneous? If Ray Rogers' findings are upheld, then that corner is heterogeneous and would go far in explaining what went wrong with the radiocarbon ring. But not everyone agrees with the suggestion of heterogeneity. Marcel Alonso in France, for example, is on record as holding to the homogeneous viewpoint. Since this may go to the heart of the issue, I believe a recap of the problem is in order. The first aspect of the issue is the presence or absence of cotton in the Ross Corner. It was the Belgian textile specialist at Ghent University, Gilbert Ross, who in 1973-1974 studied a sample removed from the shroud in 1973 and published his findings of cotton inside the linen yarns. Later, however, the French textile expert, Gabriel Vial, expressed his opinion following his own examination of the shroud that the cotton was superficial on the cloth, not spun inside, and therefore not really relevant to the issue. The reason for this lack of clarity is that, in fact, there is a lot of extraneous cotton on the surface of the shroud. This is verified in my own studies of the Max Fry sticky tapes taken from the shroud in 1978. I was in attendance at the New London Conference in Connecticut, held on October 10 and 11 of 1981. I distinctly remember a remark made by Joan Janey, now Mrs. Ray Rogers, that Stirp had found cotton spun into the linen threads in the Ross Corner radiocarbon sample area of the shroud. I recently consulted with Barry Schwartz about this, and he confirmed that Stirp was finding a lot of cotton inside the linen yarns there as opposed to the main body of the shroud where none was found. But this discovery was poorly understood then, and so it was thought that the Ross Corner area would not make a good candidate for radiocarbon test samples, which was then being designed by a committee headed up by the late Robert Dinegar. It clearly raised the question over whether any sample from that corner would be considered homogeneous and therefore suitable for testing. Stirp's preference seemed to be leaning toward taking samples from beneath the 1534 burn patches. I met with Luigi Gonella on Saturday evening, November 21, 1987, and discussed with him the possible sites on the shroud from which a sample might be taken. Gonella placed great emphasis on the conservation of the shroud, and although he would not openly admit that he was going to consider the Ross Corner, that it would be the site from which a sample would be taken, all of the implications in his conversation with me were that the Ross Corner would indeed be the best, and put that in quotes, would be the best candidate site simply because it was thought the most appropriate place since a sample had already been excised previously from this quarter for Gilbert rods. And since the royalty of Italy had stitched repairs on the patches, they wanted to preserve that history. Therefore, no samples should be removed from anywhere else on the shroud. By the end of that meeting, my growing conviction was that Gonella was leaning very strongly toward taking a single sample only from a single site, the Ra's Corner. He was perhaps following the wishes of Cardinal Balestrello, who had appointed him science advisor for the project. Following that dialogue, I conducted a series of technical phone interviews around the world with leading specialists in the field of radiocarbon dating. And from that series, I developed a white paper which summarized the collection of data. On March 22, 1988, nearly a month before the April 21 sample removal session, I sent a copy of this paper to Pope John Paul II, actually to his then secretary, Cardinal Casseroli, via his papal nuncio, Cardinal Pio Laghi, in Washington, D.C., in a diplomatic pouch. I sent a second copy to His Eminence Anastasio Cardinal Balestrello, and one to Gonella himself, urging the need for convening a new Turin workshop wherein specialists could analyze the fresh data. One of the most important points in this paper was made by Marion Scott of the International Radiocarbon Calibration Program, headquartered in Glasgow, Scotland. She asserted that a minimum of three samples must be taken from three different areas on the shroud so that the results could be compared with all other results. Without this, we would not know if the date obtained from the Ra's Corner represented the date for the main body of the shroud. I also suggested in that paper a method that could be used to circumvent Gonella's argument that royalty had helped stitch the patches. Single yarns could be teased out from under the burned patches without interfering with any of the stitches, known then to have been placed there by the royal family. But final decision, April 21st of that year, was to take samples only from the Ra's Corner. But a tool actually existed at the time of my meeting with Professor Gonella that, had I known about it, I might have been able to convince Professor Gonella to re-examine the question, the so-called blue quad mosaic. Some years before his death, I talked with the late Don Lynn about the use of remote sensing and what specialized photography of the shroud could reveal. By using black and white film, but with different colors, red, green, blue, Lynn told me that it could reveal surface chemistry through its reflectance, a kind of spectrum indicating that the surface was different from anywhere else on the shroud cloth. When one looks at the blue quad mosaic, one sees something very different at the corner from the deep orangish-red coloration of the image area. In the Ra's Corner, one sees a kind of bluish-green, a cast. What causes this? Now, Lynn told me that such special photography does not tell us what the special chemistry is. It merely indicates that we must do chemical analysis to determine what that chemical signature is. This is what Rogers' paper in Thermochemica Acta does. It confirms the presence of the mordant, aluminum, and reveals the presence of two other items, rose madder and gum arabic. The confirmation was a partial repeat of an earlier attempt, earlier finding by the late Dr. Alan Adler, who had observed salts of calcium, sodium, iron, aluminum, and other metallic species, and starch in the area of the Ra's Corner. I'll key the next one in. I'll let you know when we want to switch. In March of 1981, the late Walter C. McCrone sent me several Kodak transparencies of shots he took looking at the linen fibers on the shroud. On those slides, still preserved in my collection, Macron had written the following note: matter rose, linen fiber, medium, in parentheses he put blue, sample 3, CB, end quote. And sample 3AB, next slide please, which came from the blood flow across the back nearest the side strip side of the shroud and directly adjacent to that flow on linen itself. It was on that side where someone would have been working their repairs if the reweave theory is held to be correct. Macron, of course, due to his belief that the shroud was painted by an artist, was trying to prove that the shroud had been in an artist's studio. Hence, he sent me these photomicrographs as a piece of that evidence. But he was faithfully preserving the fact of the presence of matter rose on the cloth. There is now a new way of looking at the presence of that matter rose. Although this is some distance from the raised corner, such trace amounts can now be conjectured to explain the dye that was used, along with the aluminum mordant and the gum arabic as a binder to create the wash to finish the reweave. Thus, it may now be seen not as a contaminant from an artist's studio, but as rather a contaminant from a weaver's workshop. But if this was a reweave, somewhere on the shroud, the reweave comes to an end and the cloth of the shroud begins. It is still difficult today to discern exactly where the change takes place. Does the piece of cloth today being called by the Shroud Science Group the Reserva belong to the repair area or to the main body of the shroud? Thus, the nature of the repaired area, if it exists, seems to be characterized by a combination of the following five components based on Ray Rogers' research. Number one, linen cotton spun yarns spliced into the shroud cloth and showing a coating of 2. Starch, 3. Aluminum mordant and other metallic salts, and 4. Gum arabic binder, and 5. Matter rose dye. If other samples taken from the shroud differ from this, we need to stand back and rethink what we are looking at, perhaps engage in fresh research before we can draw final conclusions. The shroud as it exists today is beginning to look far more complex than was originally thought. Next illustration. Are there cotton fibers spun inside the linen yarns? Raz presented a very easy way to determine this. If one takes a cross-section of a yarn, one can determine the differences between linen and cotton by looking at the pentagonal shape of linen compared with the flattened look of a cotton fiber. This is further explored in appendix number 2 to my paper, which is not presented here this morning. This is John Brown's photograph here, and then the next illustration shows a light micrograph of the cotton fiber that wrapped the outside surface of Ra's yarn number R14, showing the coating of the incrustations. And then the next illustration is an SEM, that's scanning electron microscope, a photomicrograph taken by John Brown, showing the incrustation surrounding the linen fiber that came from Ra's weft yarn number R7. Note the pentagonal shape of the linen. This SEM was taken at 3,300 power. If Rogers' theory is correct, independent microscopical studies ought to be able to test it. And thus, Rogers submitted several samples of the threads from the radiocarbon sampling area to microscopist John Brown, retired research scientist with the Georgia Tech Research Institute of the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta, Georgia. In a stunning study that reinforces Rogers' own study, Brown has shown that precisely the intersections of the warp with the weft threads, the yarn was tight enough and the weave tight enough to prevent the mixture of gum arabic matter, root dye, and mordant from penetrating. Further evidence that the viscous mixture did not penetrate is found with a cotton fiber removed from the inside of the threads. Brown unraveled one end of Raz thread R14 and removed the fiber you see from that thread. But a cotton fiber that was unwound from the outer periphery of that same thread contains encrustation similar to the encrustation resulting from the viscous mixture deposited onto the surface of the cloth. It is now clear that the presence of cotton spun inside linen yarns in the Raz corner is supported by the findings of five separate independent investigators: Gilbert Raz himself, 1973-1974, Sterp's own early analyses reported by Sterp spokeswoman Joan Janey, 1981, investigators at Precision Processes Textile Lab in England, 1988, Ray Rogers' 2004 investigation, and John Brown's at Georgia Tech, 2004. This issue of homogeneity of sample was brought into significant focus by Brian Walsh at the 1999 Richmond Conference in Virginia. In his paper, quote, "The 1988 Shroud of Turin Radiocarbon Tests Reconsidered," end quote, Walsh, after careful consideration of a statistical analysis of the samples given to the various labs and their results, made the following summary statement, quote, "The statistical analysis techniques employed in the 1988 radiocarbon dating of the Shroud of Turin appear to have underestimated the potential for a non-homogeneous distribution of the radiocarbon in the shroud linen. The statistical characteristics of the data from each radiocarbon lab appear to indicate that in the case of the Oxford lab measurements, its observations were drawn from a statistically different population," end quote. Walsh concluded, quote, "Whatever the cause of this gradient, before anyone again attempts to date the Shroud of Turin using radiocarbon dating techniques, a thorough understanding of the nature and characteristics of any proposed radiocarbon enhancement mechanism in linen fiber must be developed through a series of rigorously controlled experiments which evaluate the chemistry and the isotopic behavior of the carbon atoms in linen over a wide range of physical parameters." Although Walsh was here alluding to a possible thermal event, I believe we must now expand our technical evaluations to include researches that also focus on the possibility of the inclusion of medieval cotton fibers inside linen yarns. I shall return to this dual focus at the end of this paper. The date of the shroud. Barring additional tests taken from samples of the main body of the shroud, there is no easy current answer to the question of date. What are some alternatives proposed? Rogers suggested what I will call, for want of a better description, a quasi-dating method for the shroud. In his January 2005 paper, he made comparisons between lignin in the fibers from the main body of the shroud cloth with that in samples from the Raz corner. There is a chemical component which occurs in the lignin called vanillin. Rogers discovered that all of the vanillin was gone from the fibers in the main body of the shroud, but still present in the Raz corner. Although Rogers published his finding in January of 2005, he knew that there was much more work to be done. In a series of emails between him and Brian Walsh, and I have included this in Appendix 3 for the paper, it was revealed that Rogers' revelation about the vanillin loss was a qualitative study, not a quantitative one. Moreover, the loss of vanillin may be affected by heat. This is a crucial issue, considering that the shroud was heavily damaged in the fire of December 4, 1532. Thus, far more study needs to be done before anyone can rely on the extrapolations from the lack of vanillin on the main body of the shroud compared with its presence in the Raz corner area. Recently, Australian biologist Stephen E. Jones had suggested dating the pollen grains on the Turin Shroud as a way of establishing markers for separate historical events. But as Dr. Lloyd A. Curie points out, at least 100 grains would be needed by current standards to achieve a viable result. The largest group of pollen from one plant type is that of Grundelia tournefortii, with only 29 pollen grains. If more of these could be hand-picked directly off the shroud or discovered in the vacuum dust of the late Professor Luigi Di Numano's collection, to make up the difference, such a test might be feasible. Jones, as I understand him, does not assume that these pollens were placed there at the time the shroud was woven. Rather, he believes that such a C14 test can be used as an independent means to evaluate the medieval testing dating results of 1988. Any C14 results other than the medieval date would call the medieval date into question. As of this date and time, we have no other clue to the antiquity of the shroud except for the preponderance of evidence which suggests that the shroud is ancient. As noted earlier, it must date prior to 1192 to 1195 AD, because the earliest certain rendering of the shroud in artistry is to be found in the Hungarian Prey Codex. This fact alone automatically rules out the possibility that the 1260-1390 date from the Rez Corner represents the date of the main body of the shroud. Where do we stand? When everything is properly understood, the entire picture of the shroud should come together as a beautifully constructed puzzle. If something is out of place, the whole will not look right. We are currently still in that mode. Not everyone agrees with Ray Rogers' findings. Especially in Europe, there are those who believe his findings do not represent the real nature of the shroud. Thus, this issue of homogeneity versus heterogeneity needs to be resolved so that we can move forward. If a reweave is not the explanation for the characteristics found at the Rez Corner, then we badly need an explanation for why cotton is woven into that corner, but is not demonstrated in threads in the main body of the cloth. What does the opposite side of the ledger look like? Do the X-rays of the shroud show any personal evidence of a reweave? Brian Walsh suggests they do not. Walsh notes that in discussions, quote, with textile conservators in the U.S., they said that while reweaving might be made difficult to perceive on one side of a cloth, it would be painfully obvious on the other side of the cloth because of the various threads and knots involved in stitching it. Now, I'm not arguing in this paper that the Benford, Marino, Rogers theory is the sole answer to our question, what went wrong? Nevertheless, the factors I've marshaled here suggest that it has an awful lot going for it. What the historical record suggests to me is that of all of the evidences gathered thus far, the strongest clues appear to come from two different approaches. The Russian work on carboxylation emanating from the heat event of 1532, and what, in my view, is the clear possibility of an invisible reweave. That implies that we should perhaps shift our focused application of Occam's razor for a single cause over to a multivariate approach in our continued research. Thus, we need to further explore the issues raised by Brian Walsh and others, as well as the points raised by the Benford, Marino, Rogers approach to resolve the matter. It is most unfortunate that the shroud textile has, to this day, never been fully characterized. There are scattered observations and various studies on numerous aspects, but none have ever been compiled into one reference. For this, you may see Appendix 2 of my paper, which will eventually be posted on the web. This constitutes the beginnings of such a compilation. For example, by implication, Roger seems to hold that the yarns were Hank bleached. Are they? Linda Eaton, curator for textiles at Winterthur Museum in Winterthur, Delaware, has suggested to me an alternative, that the variegation of color in the individual yarns may have to do with incomplete retting of the batch of flax that composed it. She comments, quote, "I have noticed more variation in the color of linen in this country than I was used to when I worked in the UK. Maybe because the stuff that is kept here is not always of as high quality in general, but perhaps also because the local stuff was field rather than pond or stream retted, which might also make a difference," end quote. If the shroud was woven in the Near East, where water was not always plentiful, perhaps field retting was more common, in keeping with Brian Walsh's comments, with his concerns, we must see to it that much more research is conducted and that the linen is fully characterized before there is ever another radiocarbon test conducted of the shroud. Already in some quarters, new examinations are underway on shroud samples to shed fresh light on the nature of the cloth and the threads in it. My conclusion. I began this paper with a strange story. The photo you see here is not the thread discussed in the story preserved by Bill Meacham, but it may be similar to it because it comes from the same Roz Corner. As implied earlier, an answer to the puzzle now presents itself. If the Benford, Marino, Rogers research on the reweave turns out to be correct, and that yarn was a spliced sample of old and new, then it is really quite possible to conceive of an 800-year spread producing a date on one end of 200 AD and 1000 AD on the other. It may turn out that that was quite a yarn after all, but we have a long way to go before we can resolve all the questions still hanging in midair. Thank you.
Explore the mystery at shrouduniversity.com.